Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM, www.ciut.fm over the internet. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Rob Moore co-hosting and bringing us the news today, and Lamia teching for us. We have a bit of a eclectic show for you today. Our original guest for the program for our live interview cancelled this morning, very understandably, due to newborn-related issues. So hopefully we'll have her on in the upcoming weeks to talk about vegetarianism and children. She's done some very interesting research coming out of Harvard. We are going to hear from Rob News. He'll bring us the latest happenings.
Did you say Rob News?
Rob News. Rob Moore bringing us the news.
That's my name, Rob News.
That's going to be your new, like,
I think so.
Catch name. Yeah. And then we're going to, I think, have a little discussion about a class I'm teaching.
Yes. That'd be really interesting.
I'm teaching a third-year class on animal issues at York University. We'll talk a little bit about the food fair, maybe. And we're also, I think Rob wanted to do some stuff about Steve Irwin.
Well, we'll see how it goes. Steve's in the news, obviously, this week, as many of you know. And so we may have a little talk session about that. We'll see what happens.
Okay. The pre-recorded interview that I brought in is one of my favorites. And it's actually the first show that Rob was ever involved with. I think this is September 16th, 2003. He did the news at the very beginning of the program.
This is kind of like my three-year anniversary.
It totally is.
It is.
And you too,
3 years.
You too.
Yeah, I was around a bit before you, man.
Yeah, okay.
And I was around before both y'all.
Yeah.
So this interview is, the one that we're going to be playing is about a book called Stories Rabbits Tell, A Natural and Cultural History of a Misunderstood Creature. I won't introduce it much more than that because I do an introduction on the pre-recorded show, but we are speaking in that interview with Margot DeMello. It's an absolutely delightful book, also disturbing, certainly in some parts as well. Talks about, of course, the cultural anthropology of the rabbit, not only in terms of a pet and this sort of prized and loved animal, but also in terms of the rabbit industry. It's a very fascinating interview. If you don't get to catch the whole thing, and if we're not able to play it all today, it is archived on our website, animalvoices.ca, so you can download it there as well. So without further ado, before we hear that interview, we're going to hear from Rob News.
Yeah, Rob News. We also have a survey up on our shows page of the animalvoices.ca website, and we really enjoyed reading all of the survey responses and how much you love some of our voices. Lauren and Lamia, you've gotten some special mentions.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's because your voice is so molasses-y. People feel like they don't even have to comment because it's so good. I remember when you first started doing the news, I just was like, okay, well, that's fine. Be so much better than me and have a better voice. I think that you really do have a good voice.
Yeah, you have a nice radio voice.
A great radio voice.
And enough about me, but I think perhaps we also balance each other really well and, you know, the high and the low.
My brother says I'm a bit nasal.
Really?
So I try not to be so nasal.
No, you're trying not to be so nasally, Lauren.
I lower my voice. I have my radio voice on.
The radio voice, yeah.
So
it's interesting because when I hear older interviews with you, yeah, your voice isn't as low.
I know it's gotten lower over the years.
So perhaps you've gotten conscious of that. But I think it's a great voice.
Happy anniversary, Rob.
Happy anniversary, Lamia.
I wanted to be more loving than I just was a couple minutes ago.
I beat you, man.
So yeah.
All right, let's move on to the news and why I'm actually here today. Okay, this week, horse meat, pomegranate juice, deporting animal rights activists, and avenging Steve Irwin's death, all in this week's news. First from Reuters, feminist academic Germaine Greer said last Wednesday she hoped the death of Australian crocodile hunter Steve Irwin would mark the end of what she called exploitative nature documentaries, a discordant note amid floods of tributes. Irwin died in a freak diving accident off Australia's northeast coast last Monday after he was hit in the chest by the serrated barb from a stingray's tail. Echoing comments she made this week in Britain's Guardian newspaper, Australian-born Greer likened Irwin to a lion tamer and said he had intruded on the habitats of animals and treated them with, quote, massive insensitivity. We now have enough respect for lions to be embarrassed if we see someone trying to crack whips at them and wave chairs at them. Jumping all over crocodiles is the same kind of thing, she said. And from MSNBC.com, following up on that story, at least 10 stingrays have been slain since Irwin was killed by one of the fish, prompting a spokesman for the late TV star's animal charity to urge people not to take revenge on the animals. slain stingrays since have been discovered on two beaches in Queensland state on Australia's eastern coast. Two were discovered Tuesday with their tails lopped off, State Fisheries Department official Wayne Sumpton said. Sumpton said fishermen who inadvertently catch the diamond-shaped rays sometimes cut off their tails to avoid being stung, but the practice was uncommon. Stingrays often are caught in fishing nets by mistake and should be returned to the sea, Sumpton said. Michael Hornby, the executive director of Irwin's Wildlife Warriors Conservation Group, said he was concerned the rays were being hunted and killed in retaliation for Irwin's death. It may be some sort of retribution, or it may be fear from certain individuals, or it just may be yet another callous act toward wildlife. He said killing stingrays was not what Steve was about. Some more information on stingrays. They're usually shy and obtrusive fish that rummage the sea bottom for food or burrow into the sand. They have a serrated spine up to 10 inches long on their tails, which they can lash when stepped on or otherwise frightened. The spines emit toxins that can kill many small creatures and cause excruciating pain in humans. Few people have died from the poison, but the spines can badly tear flesh and the wounds are prone to infections, including tetanus. So following the news, we may have a little talkback segment about Steve Irwin. I'm just curious if people out there, if they agree that Steve was actually intrusive on animal habitats out there, if he was just a cheap reality star, as I think someone said in the news recently, or was he really a champion for animals and he's done more for animals in terms of bringing them to light, especially all around the world throughout his nature documentaries, and so many kids know about so much more about crocodiles and snakes and sharks and all kinds of things. So we may talk about that a little bit later. We'll see how it goes. Next, from BangkokPost.com, two members of an international animal rights group were ordered to leave Singapore on Friday after disclosing plans to protest outside a KFC restaurant in the New, the organization said. Jason Baker and Ashley Fruno, citizens of the United States and Canada respectively, quote, were tracked down by police on Thursday and questioned for 9 hours before being ordered to leave Singapore, said a statement from the Asia-Pacific branch of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Police officers also searched their hotel room and belongings, PETA said. The pair had planned to hold a protest outside the KFC restaurant in downtown Singapore, wearing nothing but a banner reading, "Naked Truth, KFC Tortures Chicks." We were treated like criminals when the real crime is the way KFC tortures millions of helpless birds, said PETA Asia-Pacific Director Baker, currently residing in Hong Kong. He and Fruno were scheduled to leave that afternoon. And next from the LA Times, of the many possible targets of animal rights activists in Southern California, the world's largest distributor of pomegranate juice, Palm Wonderful, might seem low on the list. But according to a lawsuit filed last week in Los Angeles County Superior Court, the company's employees have been besieged by animal rights protesters who are angry about testing the company has done to prove its assertions that the bright red juice is an elixir of health. According to information posted on animal rights websites, activists have targeted Palm because, they say, the company has funded experiments on mice and rabbits, including lowering the brain oxygen levels in newborn mice to cause them brain injuries, and forcing their mothers to drink water mixed with pomegranate concentrate. Palm President Matthew Tupper said his company has been involved with, quote, a limited amount of animal testing, end quote. The company has asked a judge to fine activists $1,000 if they post personal information about Palm employees on websites. Company officials also want a judge to order activists not to picket or demonstrate outside the homes of the juice company's employees. The broad scope of the request took some by surprise. Timothy Alger, a First Amendment expert at the law firm Quinn Emanuel, said such a request was rare. I don't see how an employer can go to court and ask for an injunction that forbids speech about an employee, he said. Interesting, just for juice there, testing on animals. Next, from DNAIndia.com, Japan will keep horse meat on its plates despite U.S. moves to ban the slaughter of horses, as it receives an ample supply from Canada and South America, an official said on Friday. The U.S. House of Representatives voted on Thursday to ban the killing of horses for human consumption. Some 90,000 horses were slaughtered last year, with almost all the meat exported to Japan, France, or Belgium. But in Japan, where horse sashimi is a regional delicacy, only 735 of the 8,800 tons of horse meat imported last year came from the U.S., the Agriculture Ministry said. Japan's main trade partners for horse meat are Canada, Brazil, and Argentina. The three countries together account for 82% of Japan's imports of horse meat, which is seen as a lean alternative to beef and also used in pet food. Another 7,123 tons of horse meat is also produced domestically, which accounts for only 0.2% of Japan's output of all meat. The U.S. House of Representatives voted 263-146 to ban the slaughter of horses in an emotionally charged campaign by animal rights activists and horse lovers supported by celebrities such as country music legend Willie Nelson and Hollywood star Clint Eastwood. But the ban needs to be approved by the Senate, and U.S. President Bush's administration has opposed the measure. From UPI.com, a new UN report says nearly 50% of fish consumed globally now come from farms instead of being caught in the wild. The report was presented Tuesday to delegates at a meeting in New Delhi on aquaculture, sponsored by the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization. The State of World Aquaculture 2006 shows a 25% rise in the consumption of farm-raised fish since the mid-1980s. Despite the 45.5 million tons of farmed fish and 60 million tons of freshwater fish consumed worldwide, there still is a growing demand for fish, especially in well-developed nations. The FAO said 33 million tons of fish were imported in 2004, or $61 billion worth, to cater to the demand. Since the mid-80s, there has not been any significant change in the amount of fish caught in the sea. However, the FAO estimates 52% of 600 species found in the sea are fully exploited, 25% are either depleted or recovering from depletion, 20% are moderately exploited, and 3% are underexploited. And finally, from the TimesLeader.com, six animal welfare supporters face up to 7 years in prison when they are sentenced in federal court today. The members of Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty and the organization itself were convicted in March of using a website to incite threats, harassment, and vandalism against a Britain-based company that tests drugs and household products on animals. The government charged that the group waged a 5-year campaign against Huntington Life Sciences, posting on its website information about the employees at its East Millstone lab and about those who do business with the company. The information included their home phone numbers, addresses, and where their children attended school. Many of those people saw their homes vandalized, and they and their families received threatening emails, faxes, and phone calls. The defendants were not accused of directly making threats or carrying out vandalism. Instead, they were charged with animal enterprise terrorism, stalking, and other offenses. The group based in Philadelphia maintains its actions were protected under the First Amendment. The defendants, all in their late 20s or early 30s, have been released on bail. They face 3 to 7 years in prison and fines of up to $250,000. Fines also may be levied specifically against the organization during today's hearing. A long bout of news today, but that finally is it. But maybe an interesting point of news for those locally, Lauren Corman, is that you're teaching a third-year course at York University. Would you like to please tell us about that?
I don't want to say too much about it, I guess, at this point, just because we're still getting my feet wet with the course. We had the first class yesterday, and I had about 40 students show up, and there was a lot of interest. The official name of the course is called Human Non-Human Animal Relations, and it is it's a course that I designed last year called Animal Ethics and Politics. That was the original name for the course, and it is basically a course that gives students a background in animal ethics, and each week is a set of debates that each week builds upon the debates before it. And the two authors usually that are featured in the week's reading are specifically like speaking to each other. So they're actually debating each other in the readings. And each week is about looking at how animal ethics intersects with another social justice movement. So we'll do like a week on indigenous knowledge and animal ethics, and then the next week would be on like the anti-racist movements and animal issues. Next week would be on feminism and the animal movements. And so it's all about intersections between different issues and having a more and more layered analysis as you go along.
And then that is in the environmental science program at York?
It's environmental studies.
Okay.
Well, I assumed incorrectly that a lot of my students would be coming from environmental studies. And that's true. There is quite a few students from environmental studies, but there's also a lot of students from different faculties. So I have a student in geography and a couple in theater, one in psychology, political science. There's people from pretty much, it seems like, a lot of the different faculties at York University. And some of the students yesterday said, you know, well, there just isn't anything like this in my faculty, so I wanted to take this course in environmental studies, which is funny because there really isn't anything like that in environmental studies either. And so to me, it really speaks to the desire for people to have these kinds of discussions. I think that in some ways the academy is really lagging behind popular discourse in terms of talking about these issues. So it's nice to provide an academic space where students can get credit and really weigh into these issues on a scholarly level.
I think that's awesome.
Can I ask a question? Is it the first ever course of its kind there?
Well, there is this human non-human animal relations class, which a fabulous professor, Lisa Fawcett, taught as well. I think that this is a slightly different focus in terms of being what some people might call an animal rights class. It's not animal rights in the sense that it's teaching about rights philosophy exclusively, but it's rights focused in the sense that it deals with issues that are commonly associated with animal rights. So questions about animal domestication or the food industry and that kind of thing. So those types of issues I don't think really have been addressed, I know anyway, in environmental studies at a course level in the undergraduate program before. In my master's program, we did a directed studies where some of the students were talking about issues like this. But in terms of an undergraduate level, I don't think that there's been a course like this before. And the response has been overwhelming. We're maxed out at enrollment at this point.
That's awesome.
So we'll see how it goes. I'm excited about it. And the students were awesome yesterday. We had a lot of fun. Yeah, so I'll keep you posted.
Mm-hmm.
I want to invite some of them on. I didn't tell them that yesterday, but I'm thinking maybe at the end of the term I could have some folks come on if they want to share some of the work that they've produced throughout the term. We'll see.
Definitely, and just to hear about, you know, if their perceptions have changed over the time. And
what they think of the course director.
What do you think of her voice specifically?
Yeah, it was really fun. It's such an honor to feel like you're opening up a new space for conversations, and people really expressed a desire and a need for that kind of space to happen. So it's really exciting, and it's totally a thrill. I would even maybe say a dream come true for me, because I've been wanting to talk about these issues within that context and teach about this stuff for a really long time.
That's absolutely wonderful. One of my heroes, you know, Lauren, you definitely are, because it's just so inspiring to hear about. And I'll look forward to all the updates as the weeks go by.
Thanks, Rob.
As I mentioned before, the Steve Irwin thing, it's really interesting. We're going to take a break, but I'll give you a chance to call in and we can chat about it on the air. Steve Irwin, as I mentioned in the news, he died last week from a stingray barb on his tail, an accident when he was diving off the coast of Australia. Do you think that Steve's work was beneficial to our society in terms of bringing animal issues to light and just learning about animals, especially for children? Or do you think that that kind of intrusiveness, wrestling crocodiles and snakes and how he was really quite invasive in his nature documentaries, do you think that that kind of thing should be prohibited in the future, as the one person I mentioned, Germaine Greer, mentioned at the beginning? She said it was, we should know better than that. We now have enough respect, for example, for lions to be embarrassed if we see someone trying to crack whips at them and wave chairs at them. Jumping all over crocodiles is the same kind of thing. And she did go on to say in the article, and I didn't mention it here, that she did have much respect for Steve, and that his death was definitely a sad event. But just questioning the practices, his death sort of brings to light the issue of those kinds of practices in nature documentaries. I'm curious what people think out there. I'm not going to weigh in on the subject. Lauren, you're not going to weigh in on the subject?
No. I haven't really thought through it enough, and I feel like I haven't done enough research. I will say, personally, like, I thought that Steve Irwin was really jovial and, like, he had a very warm spirit, and I think he really did love animals.
Mm-hmm.
But as I've been kind of learning more about some of the debates, I realize I don't have very much background, and I didn't have enough information about, like, the sort of the filmmaking and the context and all that kind of thing. You know, I was talking to my mom about this, and she said, you know, he really seemed to love and and honor and cherish the animals that a lot of people kind of see as ugly and don't like as much. And so she was, you know, she felt sad when he died. But when you look at it more critically, maybe if you do some digging, maybe it's not as kind of rosy as the picture was presented to us. Like I said, though, I feel I haven't really done enough research to say either way. I liked him as a person and what I saw, but I don't know if that's enough to say whether or not his work was ethical.
Our phone number, if you'd like to call in and weigh in on the subject, is 416-946-7000. That's 416-946-7000. I actually haven't even seen his show, so I can't even say.
I think that it might be good, too, if we also put out the question if people wanted to talk about the vegetarian food fair, if they had a chance to go down. If you had any feedback about being at the fair this year, or if you were able to find the animal groups, they were kind of sequestered in a different area this year, so I know some people had problems finding them. If you have any feedback about the food fair, anything you loved, anything you weren't so sure about, give us a call at that number.
416-946-7000. And we may not take a break if someone wants to come on right away. Did you get to spend much time at the food fair?
Well, unfortunately, I mean, I only spent a couple of hours on Friday night. I was planning to come back on Sunday and get a chance to talk with more people, but I brought my cat in to the emergency vet clinic on Sunday because she had an abscess on her foot. So all of Sunday was gone. So I just kind of got a quick walk around on Friday. And I got to eat a tofutti cutie and say hi to some people, but I didn't get really a chance to talk to that many people or go to any of the speakers, which was unfortunate.
Yeah, me too, unfortunately, but I did get a chance to meet Dr. Colin Campbell.
Now,
as many of you know, the author of The China Study, which I just highly recommend. It's at the top of my recommended list. And so it was great to meet him and get him to sign my book, finally. And I didn't actually get a chance to see his lecture, but he said you didn't miss anything if you've read my book, Rob.
So we have Michael on the line who has a comment about Steve Irwin.
Excellent.
Michael, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi, Michael. What's your comment?
Well, I think, like I was saying earlier, I think most of the singer is a very gentle creature. So I was shocked with all the dangerous animals you've seen Steve Irwin with on television. That it would be a stinger that would take his life.
I've heard that it was the third death by a stingray in all of recorded Australian history.
Right,
he's number three.
Yeah, I mean, it suggests to me that maybe the stingray itself was being irritated or provoked, kind of like jumping on the alligators or jumping on the crocodile, something. It would take something like that to really cause that to happen, you would think.
The news report I read did say that that they only lash out when they're stepped on or otherwise frightened.
Yeah, so they have to take an irritation. It wasn't, I can't see just swimming along with stingrays or something of that nature causes stingrays to react.
So then, Michael, do you think that Steve was a little obtrusive with animals?
I think that sometimes the whole money-making issue got glorified. I mean, I'm sure he loved animals, but I think sometimes he went to the extra. I mean, for the television.
For the reality TV stunt.
Really.
Okay, Michael, thanks for your comment.
Okay, thanks.
Okay,
thanks.
Take care. So, Lamia mentioned three deaths in Australian history. I think I read 17 in all of the world's history of stingrays.
Wow.
And so, you know, 17, it seems kind of an odd thing that indeed he was killed.
And for him to have wrestled with so many crocodiles, like I've seen the show a couple times. And the phone's ringing. One sec, listener. I'm just shocked.
And and snakes and swimming with sharks. And so, as Lauren mentioned, you know, your mom said he really sort of brought a civility to these creatures who we often see as dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and quite often, like, for example, sharks, sometimes they're not exactly dangerous. If they bite, it means they have no food. We're overfishing. Mm-hmm. There's lots of things to consider. So
that all these animals are lovable in their own way.
Indeed.
Lana, but it's more complicated than that.
Yeah,
we have Paul on the line. Paul, are you there?
Hello.
Hi, Paul.
How are you doing?
Good.
How
are you?
I'm all right. Regarding Steve Irwin.
All right.
I'm a vegan animal rights person myself.
Okay.
And I felt like most, I guess, animal rights people that he was an animal tormentor and that what he was doing was wrong. But I've subsequently found out from Captain Watson of the Sea Shepherd that In fact, he was a tremendous conservationist, and he spoke out against the seal slaughter, the whale slaughter, the dolphin slaughter, and he did a tremendous amount of conservation work that most people are unaware of, including myself. And so that sort of changes my opinion of him tremendously. I still don't agree with his tormenting the animals, but, I mean, this is how he became successful. If he didn't do that, if he wasn't such a larger-than-life character, he wouldn't be able to do any conservation work, or not near the amount he was able to do. And so, I mean, you have to weigh that against the good work he's done. I'm sure it's not something he did, you know, callously. It was something he did in order to generate viewership, and that's what he did. So I think you have to weigh also, you know, he didn't really advertise a lot of the conservation work he did, so most people are only familiar with his television shows. And I think when you see the whole picture, then perhaps we could have a kinder of opinion of him.
It's true, Paul. I read that, that he's given millions of dollars to conservation groups around the world, and that he really avoided the kind of rich Hollywood lifestyle that he really could have afforded because he was, you know, so popular the world over. So that's true. I mean, that has kind of gotten buried, and that's not what's making headlines right now, so that is something to consider.
Right, and just on a related note, yesterday was the world premiere of Shark Water by Rob Stewart, a local Toronto fella. And the Sea Shepherd and Captain Watson were part of that. It's a film about the wanton slaughter of sharks simply for their fins. 100 million sharks per year. 90% of the sharks have been slaughtered in the last 50 years. They're the top predator in the food chain. They've been around for 400 million years. They're the longest living animal. They outlived the dinosaurs, and once that top predator in the sea's food chain is gone, which it almost is now, who knows what's going to happen. Possibly things will collapse. The plankton will then collapse, which provides, you know, the oceans provide 70% of our oxygen, and then, of course, if we're still around at that time, we will collapse also. So it was a very good film, and most people aren't aware that most people don't care about sharks. They think they're killers, when in fact they're not. They're more afraid of us.
And this film, Paul, it debuted at the Toronto International Film Festival.
It was
right?
on yesterday, yes, and they were both there, and they spoke. And it's also showing on Thursday, September 14th at the Varsity 8.
Do you know if it's going to be released commercially?
Yeah,
in theaters?
In 2007, yes, it is.
All right. Well,
but I would you know, urge anyone who's interested in this. They're fantastic animals, and they've been maligned by the media. Sharks are not killers. And it's time that we started caring about them.
Indeed.
Thank you for your comments. And we'll definitely do a follow-up with that film and also hopefully focus a program on sharks as well.
Right. And the dolphin slaughter, I believe, is coming up on the 20th.
Yeah, Rick O'Berry is going to be on next week to talk about that and to give us the details on worldwide protests. So stay tuned for that next week.
Fantastic.
Thanks for calling, Paul.
See ya.
Okay, bye. Again, our phone number is 416-946-7000 if you'd like to call in.
Techie Power coming over here. We have to go to station identification.
Definitely. Let's do that.
And
shall
we play a song or not, team?
We will if no one decides to call in. And then we're going to go to the pre-recorded interview with
Margot
DeMello, author of Stories Rabbits Tell. You've been listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. Again, our phone number, 416-946-7000.
You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM, University of Toronto Community Radio. We are back with Animal Voices, and we have Jack on the line.
Good morning, everybody. Hi there. Great show today.
Thanks.
Good morning, Jack.
Hi there. Just wanted to make some comments about the late Mr. Irwin. And as the first caller, I believe, mentioned, with the way that, the way that stingrays are, as one commentator said, you know, he was really quite shocked in the news clips right after the news came out that Mr. Irwin would die this way because the stingray was considered to be the pussycat of the sea. And as we have heard since, that there was filming going on the Barrier Reef when this happened. So you have to imagine there was at least two people crowding this animal in shallow water, and then it lashed its tail up and punctured him in the chest. So that's just one issue. And the other thing is that you know, obviously he's become wildly popular, and I do appreciate that he's encouraged people to, you know, admire and understand more about reptiles and things like that, which they certainly need. But, you know, you have millions of little kids that are watching this guy, and he's grabbing these struggling mambas and cobras and everything else like that and holding them up to the camera. Is this really the right message to be sending out to kids about the way to learn and understand about natural history and reptiles instead of just, you know, having a narrator talk about how they fit into the ecosystem and how they live and survive?
Mm-hmm.
And just one thing, I hadn't seen this clip, but I heard that his wife, Terry, was at some captive animal farm or someplace where there was a bear behind a fence, and she put peanut butter on her cheek and let the bear lick it off her cheek. Now, I have any number of concerns about interactions between people and bears, and bears unfortunately dying after they learn to associate people with food. I just wonder, what is the educational value of doing something like that, if that indeed was the case, just as, you know, all the controversy about him holding his infant son when he fed the crocodile.
Right.
And there was a humorous cartoon which showed that he accidentally got it wrong and, you know, was holding the chicken, and we know what happened to the kid. But anyway, the thing is, he explained that he was in control, and he was so upset that people were criticizing him for doing that. And a lot of people just considered it to be really ridiculous grandstanding for him to do that in front of an audience with his child. So these are a number of concerns about this kind of person when they get in the media and how they present themselves with animals, etc. I'd like to leave you with.
Yeah, Jack, but perhaps it does show children that, one, it's okay to invade the habitat of animals, and two, these creatures like crocodiles and sharks and whatnot, that they appear actually more docile than we have come to believe them to be, which, as you say, if we become invasive with their territory, even something as gentle as a stingray, well, you know, the damage, of course, is severe. So, indeed, that's an issue, too, educating our children. What kind of message are we sending them? Thanks, Jack, for your comment.
Sure thing. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
In some ways, his comments remind me of animal advocates' critiques of zoos, that, you know, people who are pro-zoo will often say, well, this is educational for animals, but it's like, what are the other messages that come along with its presentation of animals in these contexts? You know, what does it tell children about how animals can be treated? And anyway, those types of concerns seem to mirror some of those similar concerns that people have about zoos as well.
We can take one or two more calls at 416-946-7000 to either weigh in on the Steve Irwin issue, or as well, for local callers in Toronto, you can call in and talk about your experiences at the Toronto Vegetarian Food Fair this past weekend. It's true, zoos and just the encroaching on animal habitats and whatnot. I mean, the basis of animal rights is, if we can bring it down to a base, is really just to leave animals alone. Right, to give them their own space and to give them their own environment in which to live. And Jack also had an interesting point to make that if we, for example, with bears, if we show them that food can be associated with humans, or if we're teaching them that humans can be associated with any kind of thing like that, then they're going to encroach on our habitat, which results in us tending to kill them to leave us alone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this kind of a dangerous pattern that emerges if we let that to happen.
It's interesting, too, you know, you think about what we mean by love and respect of animals. And, you know, people can say, well, we love and respect these animals in the sense that we bring them into, like, a human context, a human culture, and we read them through our own value system. So we're going to value the docile animals. We're going to value the animals that are friendly to us in terms of our reading of them. But can we generate a love and respect that's on their terms, within their own habitats, doing their own thing, that really doesn't have anything to do with us, too? You know, maybe it's about shifting the sort of the criteria for respect or the criteria for love as well.
Good point. All right, we're going to go to our interview with Margot DeMello, author of Stories Rabbits Tell. We've got about 20 minutes. So you'll hear 20 minutes of this interview. I believe the interview was about 45 minutes long, so the rest of it is archived on our website, animalvoices.ca. Just search by guest under D.
Yeah, under DeMello. It's DEMELLO. This is Margot, and this was one of my favorite interviews of all time on the show. Really just found her approach. This is a co-author of this book, Stories Rabbits Tell, A Natural and Cultural History of a Misunderstood Creature. co-authored with Susan E. Davis. You're listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5. I just want to quickly plug our survey if we don't get a chance to come back on air before the end of the program. Rob has set up a wonderful survey on our website, animalvoices.ca. Give us some feedback about the show. It will influence how we run things on the program, and we'd love to hear from you.
And it's on the show's page, just so you know. So click on shows, and it's at the top, and you'll see it right there.
Okay, thanks.
You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and the GTA. Today on Animal Voices, we're going to be speaking with Margot DeMello, who co-authored a book called Stories Rabbits Tell, A Natural and Cultural History of a Misunderstood Creature. It's a really cool book. I thought I would give you a bit of an introduction to who Margot DeMello is. She's the president and executive director of the House of Rabbit Society, and a nationally known expert on rabbit behavior. She holds a PhD in cultural anthropology and is the author of Bodies of Inscription, A Cultural History of the Modern Tattoo Community. So from tattoos to rabbits. Margot, are you on the line?
I'm on the line.
Oh, hi, Margot. How are you
hi.
Doing? Thanks for being on the program today.
Sure.
This is such a great book. I was completely astounded by my lack of knowledge about rabbits. I think, like many people who maybe are not eating rabbits and do not have them as pets or companion animals, really the only interactions that I've had with rabbits is sort of through fictional characters. So I'm thinking of the Easter Bunny, maybe not so fictional, the Easter Bunny and, you know, Thumper from Bambi and those types of characters. Mm-hmm. So it was really incredible for me to pick up this book, and I was impressed to hear or to learn that you have a number of rabbits, or I guess they live with you or near you. 22
yeah.
rabbits?
Right now I think I'm living with 36 rabbits.
Wow. So I'd like to talk more about that too and how that influences your experience and wanting to write this book. But I was wondering if you could give us a little bit of a synopsis of the book and then tell us about some of the research that you did to write Stories Rabbits Tell, A Natural and Cultural History of a Misunderstood Creature.
Well, the short synopsis is just as you said, it's a natural and cultural history of rabbits. We wanted to look at the human-rabbit relationship through time and across cultures. So it originally began with contrasting images and representations of rabbits in folklore and art and mythology and in film and in literature with the quote-unquote reality of rabbits, how rabbits actually live. That's how the book began. It wasn't until we were already researching and writing that we thought, hey, why don't we put in some information about how rabbits live outside of our homes and outside of, you know, the companion animal world as meat animals and as fur animals and as laboratory tools. Mm-hmm. And that's how the book expanded to include those sections, which both Susan and myself feel are really, really important, yet we are alarmed to hear so far, the book has only been out a couple of weeks, but so far a lot of the rabbit lovers who are reading the book are skipping those chapters because they don't want to hear what actually happens to rabbits. So that's it tells us a lot about rabbits and why they continue to be treated the way that they are in the ways that they are ignored by the animal rights community largely and can't even be given that kind of consideration even within the rabbit lovers community.
Mm. I guess I should mention quickly before, because I didn't, you co-authored this book with Susan E. Davis.
Yes.
So what's her background then? What background did she bring to writing this book?
Susan is a journalist. She's a highly respected writer. She writes in all kinds of magazines around the country and has a number of books herself. And she and I have a connection in that she adopted her first rabbit from me about 8 years ago, I think it was, and we've just stayed close. She became one of our first educators here in the Bay Area. She just has a real good way with both understanding rabbits and talking to people about rabbits. Mm-hmm. So a few years back, she came up with the idea of writing a book together, which sounded fun at the time, and we didn't realize how many years that would take, mm-hmm. how many publishers would turn the book down, and what a huge journey it would be.
Right.
So we both worked together through House Rabbit Society, and we're friends, and we both, of course, have rabbits.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a really extensive book. I mean, that's one of the things that struck me about it. It's very thorough. It's, in the beginning of the book, I think it's perhaps in Jeffrey Mason's foreword to the book where he talks about, you know, a book like this really hasn't been written before. So I would imagine from a researcher's point of view, you know, if there's nothing out there like this, it must have been overwhelming at times about, you know, just what to include and how extensive could you be.
It was, and honestly, right up to the last stages of copy editing, we were popping more information in all the time. Every time something new came out about cloning, we'd stick it in. Every time a new disease came out, you know, like monkeypox and SARS, we would stick that in. Any kind of a connection that would happen, and things are happening all the time that people don't think about the relationship to rabbits or some of the larger issues surrounding them, but there is so much that could go in, and we continue to find more information that if we were ever to rewrite the book, we would put in. But, you know, on the one hand, there was so much to say, and it is the only book that has said everything that it said, and on the other hand, it barely got published because of the fact that so many publishers, I can't tell you how many dozens of publishers turned it down, and they all pretty much said the same thing. If this book was about dogs, we'd absolutely publish it, but who's going to want to read a book about rabbits?
Oh, yeah, I wanted to make sure that people could get a hold of the book. It's available through Lantern Books. You can contact them directly at the website.
You can buy it through bookstores. It should be out in the bookstores. House Rabbit Society also sells it as a fundraiser, both on our website and through our chapters across the country. Our Vancouver chapter in Canada has it as well, and they're selling it. But it should, I haven't seen it yet in the bookstores, but it should be available at your normal, you know,
right.
Bookstores.
And if people are burning to get a copy of one, you know, right away, could they contact us at lanternbooks.com directly?
Oh, sure.
Okay, so that's also a possibility as well. So you mentioned that it looks at the history. You're tracing a history of human and animal relationships, so human and rabbit relationships. How far did you go back in terms of the history?
We went back thousands of years to the earliest, you know, signs of European rabbits to the early signs of domestication, and way back before that to fossils from, you know, species that predate rabbits that rabbits might have evolved from. So we went back as far as we possibly could. Susan is really responsible for the chapter on the wild rabbit and just really, really dug into everything that she could possibly find.
I know that we can possibly cover the whole history of the rabbit, but can you give us a little bit of a snippet of how humans first really began interacting extensively with rabbits? So, you know, in terms of domestication perhaps, or having them as pets, how did it start and where?
It pretty much started within the Greek and Roman world, where rabbits were prey animals, which is what they've pretty much been around the world, whether they're rabbits or hares, which, by the way, are different species, and we talk about that, although the iconography of the rabbit and the hare is often very similar, so we sort of blend the two. But they've primarily been a prey species. They've been an animal to be hunted around the world, and in the Greek and Roman world in particular, you've got them as an animal who's hunted and who is also associated very, very early on with a number of goddesses and a number of different mythologies, primarily associated with fertility, with sexuality, with sensuality, with procreation, with regeneration, and a number of different themes all related to really the rabbit's, you know, highly honed kind of sexual and reproductive abilities. So in terms of domestication, there's two sort of ways you can talk about domestication. There's people simply confining and not really controlling the breeding, but confining and using rabbits. And that happened in about the 6th century. French monks, this is sort of an interesting little factoid, thought that rabbit fetuses were aquatic, and therefore they were okay to eat during Lent. And so they were confining these rabbits in these little sort of walled warrens that were called lepraria, and they were just sort of semi-wild animals but living within a confined area where the monks then could not control their breeding but allow them to breed and then, you know, eat them. They weren't actually domesticated in the sense that we talk about domestication today, where you domesticate for color and for size and for temperament, etc., until about the 16th century, so it was much, much later, you know, after the advent of genetics and that kind of thing, that rabbits were domesticated in the more modern sense.
Hmm.
So it's really, it's a fairly, even though there's a long history of rabbit-human interaction, certainly to the detriment of the rabbit side of the relationship, there's a long history of that relationship, but it's not really, they're not really a domesticated animal until very, very, very late in the game, and unlike, you know, say dogs.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that, you know, if this were, if you were writing a book about cats or dog, you know, there would have been, you might have had more response, more positive response from publishers. So what is it about rabbits that people aren't willing to think of, you know, as worthy of consideration?
Right. They're an animal that gets so, so little respect. And we think that a lot of that has to do with their association with women and children throughout history, all the way up until, you know, in today's society. Within the pet world, rabbits are seen as children's pets or as starter pets. They're seen as these small, cheap animals that one can buy, put in a little cage, either in the backyard or in the kids' bedroom, you know, and forget about. They're only going to live a couple of years, and it's a fun thing for the kid to have and to hold. And that modern understanding or misunderstanding of the rabbit, again, goes back thousands of years just in terms of their relationship to children. They're related to children because of the fact that the fact that they're associated with Easter is because there's a lot of things there, but one of them is that they're associated with regeneration, with birth, with rebirth, and so you've got sort of the innocence and the birth of the young associated with the rabbit, and then because of their association with women, because of their sexual abilities and their high level of fertility, you've got the women and children thing that has changed back and forth through history up until the Middle Ages, when rabbits were strongly associated with witches and women were actually executed because they were thought to be you know, to transform themselves into rabbits. I mean, it's had so many different guises through over the years, but one thing that has been constant is this connection with women and children. And because, in my opinion, because of the fact that they're associated with women who are belittled and undermined and have, you know, fewer rights than men, and because they're associated with children who have absolutely no rights and are completely seen as, you know, not worthy of any kind of respect, the rabbit himself or herself also is treated that way. Dogs are man's best friend. They're associated with men over women. They're associated with adults, and they're an animal that, of course, they're also abused, especially in other countries, but also within laboratories here in this country. But they have a level of respect in this culture that the rabbit is far, far, far from having.
When you started writing the book, did you have a sense of how rabbits are currently being exploited? I mean, I hadn't thought about a specific rabbit meat industry, although I've been in shops before where they'll have, you know, skinned rabbits sitting there for sale. You know, and this is, to me at the time, it was very jarring to see these rabbits presented in this way. But I certainly don't know a lot about the rabbit meat industry. Is there a meat industry that's just based on rabbits, or is it sort of small animals in general? Or
it's a rabbit-only industry. What's confusing about it is that there are about 800 million rabbits per year that are slaughtered for the meat industry. Most of those are not in the United States, so it's only about 8 million in the United States. So because the numbers are much smaller than they are for, you know, chickens and for pigs, it escapes the notice of a lot of people because the bulk of the industry is outside of this country. It definitely escapes the notice of many people. In this country, rabbit meat is associated primarily with the poor, with the rural poor, but it's really the industry itself is trying to organize. The industry itself is trying to become an upscale. They're trying to become the providers of an upscale meat, because evidently people need to have yet more and more kinds of meat that they can eat. So they, you find rabbit meat now in a lot of very, very high, you know, kind of upscale restaurants. It is typically, the name is often hidden. The rabbit is rarely ever you know, displayed in the restaurant in any kind of a shape or form that looks like rabbit, because the chefs know and because the rabbit producers know that people still don't really want to eat rabbits. They don't want to think about rabbits, but they don't really want to eat them either. So there's a lot of kind of disguising going on of the animal.
Do they use a specific language then to
French is often what's used.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you said that most of the rabbits killed for meat are not being killed in North America or in America. Where are they being?
China is a huge area where rabbits are slaughtered. Europe is also a huge source.
And
of
then
rabbits.
We're importing them from there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then they're being eaten around the world as well. In Europe, they're very common.
Hmm. So that's part of the industry. What about the rabbit fur industry? Is that also?
That's also primarily out of the country. It's also a tough one. Part of what's hard with looking at any of these industries, including the pet industry, by the way, is that so many of the breeders and so many of the quote-unquote processors actually breed for multiple purposes. They breed for meat, for fur, for pets, even for vivisection. There's also a large portion of the American industry that's completely unregulated, because if the numbers are small enough, and there's a ton of, you know, backyard breeders who breed, you know, smaller numbers of rabbits, then it completely escapes regulation. And so many of the breeders, and Susan really could testify to this because she's the person who's done the interviews with the breeders and the processors, and she's also been the person who lurks on the meat lists and the different industry email lists. They talk all the time about how, you know, they're used for, I mean, they basically will sell them for whatever they can sell them for. And so a lot of the breeders are not specific to one industry or another. It's whatever they can make the profit from. Mm. Which is something you would never find in the cat or the dog or any other sort of pet producing industry, where a breeder would say, oh yeah, you want to buy this, you know, golden retriever for a pet? Oh, that's great. Oh, this one I guess is defective, so we'll go ahead and we'll sell this one for snake food. I mean, you just simply would never find that.
Mm. Although there is the issue of puppy mills. I mean, I wonder if the conditions are similar.
They are very similar. The ways that the animals are warehoused in those cages is absolutely similar. But again, number one, puppy mills horrify people, and there have been a lot of press about puppy mills in this country. Mm. And readers or folks who see it on 60 Minutes or, you know, Dateline are absolutely horrified. Of course, the laws haven't changed yet. There's still all those puppy mills and very, very little USDA oversight. But people are horrified. But the second thing is those animals, even if they're being warehoused, even if they're being culled, are not being consumed either by the breeders or just sold straight out from the puppy mills into, you know, the meat or the fur industry, although, as we know, some of them are sold into the vivisection industry. Mm-hmm. So there's certain things that we tolerate. There's a certain level of cruelty and abuse that we tolerate in quote-unquote man's best friend, but we don't tolerate everything. Whereas rabbits, it's pretty much, it's up for grabs. Whatever can be done to a rabbit is done to a rabbit.
Hmm. Do you you talk about this in the book, about notions of the rabbit, you know, this idea of the dumb bunny.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I mean, one of the really great things about the book is that a lot of, there's just a lot of myths that are shattered through reading it. Can you talk a little bit?
Unfortunately, we've come to the end of the hour on Animal Voices. So if you want to listen to the rest of that interview, it will be on the website, which is www.animalvoices.ca. Thank you, listeners, for listening to today's interesting show. Up next is Roadrunner. See you next week.